Hi, it's Mike Collins. WFAE is in the midst of its end-of-year fundraising campaign. We're bringing you this podcast without fundraising breaks. But first, I do have a quick pitch before we get to the show. Everything we do at WFAE is paid for by our listeners. Consider supporting Charlotte Talks right now for $20 a month, and we'll send you a Public Radio Nerd t-shirt. Give online at WFAE.org or call 704-549-9000. And thank you for your support. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Once a month, Mayor Vi Lyles joins us to talk about all things Charlotte, but the mayor is working elsewhere on city business, so we're going to take this opportunity to meet three of City Council's new members who were sworn in just last week. Victoria Watlington is here from District 3. Thank you for joining us.
No problem.
And Renee Perkins-Johnson represents District 4. Thank you for being here.
I'm happy to be here.
Malcolm Graham returns to City Council after representing this area in the State Senate. He represents District 2. Welcome back to you.
Good morning, Mike.
And at-large member and Mayor Pro Tem Julie Iseult is also with us. Good to see you again.
Good morning, Mike.
Nice to have you here. Our city's homicide problem is the key issue for the mayor and for council. We'll talk about that, about money for Major League Soccer, and other issues that are top of mind for these new members and for council. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. And I want to start with the two newcomers, because you're not really a newcomer, Malcolm. I want to talk to the two newcomers here, Victoria Watlington and Renee Perkins-Johnson. This is not an easy job, and I got a news flash for you. It doesn't pay much. So why did you want to be on council? And I'll start with District 3, Victoria.
Sure. So I wanted to be on council simply because the things that we as a community were working on really are driven by a lot of the decisions that council makes. And because of the change that's happening in our community over in District 3, it was very important that we had not only a plan, but we also had a clear voice coming from council, speaking to policies and making sure that we were prioritizing the work that we needed on our side. So for me, it was an extension of the work that I was doing in the community as part of the West Boulevard Coalition.
So for those who don't know exactly where District 3 is, Where is it?
Sure. So District 3 is West and Southwest Charlotte. So pretty much everything south of Freedom Drive and west of South Boulevard, almost out to the Catawba. Okay. So minus a couple precincts.
Okay. So you got the outlet malls.
Mm-hmm. In the airport.
Renee's from District 4. Why did you want to be on council?
For me, it was just a matter of serving at a higher level. I'm currently a nonprofit founder. I work with individuals who are formerly incarcerated, disabled, on fixed incomes. And in trying to serve those individuals and trying to find them affordable housing, it was just challenging. So this is truly to serve on a greater scale and to be a part of the decisions that impact.
And if I'm right, you've only lived here for about 4 years, is that right?
Four and a half.
So what does a fresh set, what kind of a perspective does a fresh set of eyes bring to this?
I think it gives me a very objective perspective, meaning I see things with that fresh set of eyes. I don't have any preconceived notions. I don't have a political agenda. It's so interesting when I was running there, I see people and they say, well, why didn't you call me? And I'm thinking, I don't know who you are.
There's something to be said about that, isn't it? And where is District 4?
District 4 is the university area. Okay. So it runs from Highland Creek to down to, from Hidden Valley up to Highland Creek, that whole area.
And Malcolm, you were on City Council prior to your stint at the State Senate, and you also took a stab at running for the House of Representatives in Washington, and that was an unsuccessful bid, but congratulations for doing it. But you had big political ambitions. Why come back to council?
The ambitions are still big, right? The goal is service and providing representation to the community, whether it's at a federal level or a local level. Charlotte is the 16th largest city in the country. The issues that we are facing are humongous. Our crime rate, economic development, affordable housing, any type of issues that a big city across this country is facing, we're facing as well. And so I think the experience that I bring by serving on council before working at the state level, understanding how Washington works and the folks up there makes me uniquely qualified to come back and work with the council members to learn from Victoria and Renee in terms of their fresh perspective and working with them, working with the current mayor, who I've worked with on a number of community projects before as a council member. We've worked together in the nonprofit environment as well. So working with Mayor Lyles and the staff. So I'm just ready to do the work. As I said, when I got sworn in, I came back to do big things. I'm not interested in doing small things. And so I'm ready.
You got some big things to handle, I'll tell you. Just in the next couple of weeks, as a matter of fact, we talk about Major League Soccer in a little bit. Where's District 2?
District 2 is the second largest district of them all, from Coolwood, Mountain Island Lake, 2nd, 3rd Ward, West Trey Street, Baysford Road, parts of Tuckasegee, and Freedom. So it's uniquely diverse, from million-dollar homes in Mountain Island Lake to 2nd, 3rd Ward in Uptown Charlotte. The Panther Stadium is in the district, so it's quite diverse and big.
The new one or the old one?
Is there a new one?
The highest at-large vote getter is generally named the mayor pro tem, and not only, and that's true because you were voted back in as mayor pro tem for the second time,
yes,
time, right?
Unanimously,
you are the returning champion here, Julie Eisels. So, how do you see your role as mayor pro tem?
I think that as Malcolm said, and as you've said, we've got some huge issues to deal with that we've already started and we've laid the foundation for. But as mayor pro tem, I see that my role as, first of all, forwarding the agenda of the council and of the mayor, and hopefully that's one in the same agenda. But if we can do that as a council and collaboratively, then we're going to be successful. So it's really sort of understanding not only what current incumbent council members want to accomplish, but also what new council members want to accomplish, so that people feel that they have a voice and we can work collectively on an agenda that's good for the community.
Prior to the election, a Republican group was running television ads in support of your candidacy and that of Mayor Vi Lyles. These are a national group. You know, they were not from Charlotte.
Correct.
How do you explain that?
I don't know, because I've never met them. I've never talked to them. I've never been introduced to them. They were out of Raleigh, and I suspect that was a referendum on who maybe they didn't want to have in office.
Okay.
I mean, that's, you know, the fact of the matter is
there was no,
you can't
there was nobody running against the mayor, really, to speak of. So why run ads in support of her?
You have to ask her that. I don't know. But
this is an 11-member council with only three new members and a returning champion. And all three of the newcomers ran for seats that were being vacated by those who decided not to run again or who decided to run for an at-large seat and didn't win that at-large seat. So you didn't have to go up against somebody and criticize their past policies. What was your view of the jobs being done by the members of the previous council, and how do you see the direction of this council changing now that the three of you, Renee, Victoria, and Malcolm, are on council?
Mm-hmm.
Renee. Or Victoria, I'm sorry.
Oh, no. You're fine.
That's okay.
Okay. So for me, I did not run as a response to the previous council member's job. It wasn't for me about what job had been or had not been done. As you said, we knew that the seat was going to be vacated. So for me, it was about how do we go forward knowing where we're trying to go strategically and with a community-led focus.
Okay. Renee?
Same thing with me. I knew that Councilman Phipps was not running, so that's why I decided to run. As a servant, to serve on a greater scale, he's been very gracious. So during the transition, I've worked closely with him. I've met with him. He's introduced me to you know, community leaders. So I aspire to run as excellently as I thought that he did. Additionally, I bring a human services perspective. So I'm really representing the people. I have a real estate background, so I think that's what's unique. I have a real estate background, so I can strategically work with the developers and understand real estate development. But my human services perspective, I'm really going to be advocating for that balance.
And you have a lot of institutional memory and understanding of the area and the state and the city, and I'm sure that you sat back and watched the previous councils, not just the last one, but the one prior to that, when you were in the state legislature, and had a lot of opinions. What's your take?
I did, and Justin Hollow did a fantastic job, so my job is just to pick up the baton and keep it moving forward. But there were a number of things as a citizen who I was for 4 years watching council, and that was disappointed in, right? Losing the CIAA, $50 million economic impact to our community. I thought the council had the answer to the test, and we still flung. Right. The consolation prize, from my perspective, was getting the RNC, which I, as a citizen, went to council and spoke against when they had the public debate. I thought the council needed a little bit more thoughtful consideration around big issues. It's nothing that the council did wrong. It was like, can we have a little bit more deep thinking about some of the issues that we're responding to, versus saying, yeah, I think the RNC is a good idea, let's go do it, versus the impact they may have.
So we do have a lot of big challenges ahead and a lot of big decisions to make. And in that, and some of those big decisions are coming up. They're coming up right now. I mean, when you leave this room, you may have to make one of these decisions, quite honestly. And we'll talk about all of those things and more when we come back with Julie Iselt, the mayor pro tem, Malcolm Graham from District 2, Victoria Watlington from District 3, and Renee Perkins-Johnson from District 4. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with three new members of City Council, Victoria Watlington from District 3, Renee Perkins-Johnson from District 4, kind of a newcomer, Malcolm Graham from District 2. He's back from a stint in the state legislature, and Julie Iselt, who's the returning mayor pro tem. In her speech following her swearing in for her second term, Mayor Lyle stressed that public safety and transit would be her top priorities heading into 2020. Is the council on board with those priorities, Julie?
Transit, I think so, yes. Public safety, I haven't seen it yet, I'll be honest. I think we've got to hit it a lot harder. We're doing data collection right now, which is fine. But I think that if you talk to those that are in the trenches on public safety, there's a lot more we could be doing.
So when you say you're doing data collection, the mayor stressed, I believe, conducting a study to see,
yes,
what neighborhoods were being impacted by our rise in homicides. Is that correct?
Well, I think it's also it also involves looking at what programs work and what don't work. And some of them are looking at programs around the country like Cure Violence, what works and what doesn't work. But I don't know how much we're doing around the neighborhoods and how much really needs to be done. I think we have a lot of that information.
Okay. Our homicide problem is one of the things that the mayor spoke directly about last week, and she's spoken about it many times on this program, as has Chief Kerr Putney, the police chief. He's addressed it frequently and emotionally. We had 58 homicides in 2018. At the time of the swearing-in last Monday, we had 103. There have been more since last Monday. Malcolm, you called this a public health crisis. And unlike medical health crises, this cannot be solved by a vaccination or an antibiotic or quarantine. So how does this need to be addressed?
Well, I think Julie's right. We have to do more than just collecting the data. We have to really be intentional about solving the problem across government lines. We have to go to Raleigh and suggest to them very strongly that we need more money for our judicial system, more money for our DAs, more technology to process crimes, more laws in the books in terms of repeat offenders. We got to get these guys off the street. So we have to be very intentional about working in Raleigh as well as with our district attorney's office.
So you are on exactly the same page as your Republican colleague, Tariq Bakari, mm-hmm, on council, who said exactly the same thing. And DA Spencer Merriweather has said that. The public defender has said that. Members of the court system have said that, all on this program. Chief Putney has said it. Julie Iselt has said it. Charlotte seems to be in a good place at the moment with Raleigh, if all indicators are accurate. is now the time to go to Raleigh and say we need help? Because it not only affects these shortages within the court system are statewide, and they are particularly egregious in urban areas. So is now the time to go? Maybe team with Wake County and Durham County and go?
I think you're absolutely right. This is uniquely urban in terms of the response that we have to get from Raleigh, Guilford, Wake, New Hanover, and Nashville. They're all experiencing the same type of issues. And so now's the time, from my perspective, to go in a bipartisan way to talk with a Democratic governor and a Republican.
Well, you were there. Yes. You were in the Republican legislature.
Yes.
Do they get it? Do they care? Because we're Charlotte. Do they care?
You know, if you ask me when I was there, they didn't care at all. There was an agenda against urban communities for whatever reason it was, mm-hmm. maybe because these urban communities had Democratic mayors, and there's a lack of statesmanship in Raleigh in terms of doing what's in the best interest of the people, whether it's a Democratic city or a Republican city. Hopefully we've moved beyond that. I think the mayor and Julie and others have done a great job in terms of trying to bridging the gap beyond HB2, which really divided the community. Now that the legislature is getting a lot more closer together in terms of D's and R's, where hopefully 2020 will bring it even closer together, that we will find a way to do things in a bipartisan way.
But Republicans are the law and order party. So when they see this rising homicide number, and I don't think, is it particular to Charlotte? I mean, did they have problems like this in the other urban areas of North Carolina?
I want to mention something that Malcolm said. Republicans are the law and order party, sort of branded
traditionally.
That. Traditionally have branded themselves that way. So they do focus on law enforcement. But what Malcolm's saying is what we've been saying for a decade. I said it in Neighbors for Safer Charlotte a decade ago. It's the court system. If the court system doesn't have the money to prosecute properly, if the court system can't give resources to the court for diversion programs or for special family courts, drug courts, then it ends up on the backs of law enforcement. And that's the difference. If you can't fund the court system, it's going to end up back on the streets and back in the hands of the police department.
So this may not be a fair question to ask of Renee, because she's only been here 4.5 years, but I'll give you a shot at it, and also to Victoria and the rest of you. But fellow Councilman Braxton Winston has spoken about addressing economic and educational inequities and the need to improve economic mobility, and he referred to, in his speech last Monday, to the problematic, this is a quote, problematic intentional policy carried out by past councils and civic leaders, specifically the urban renewal plan backed by the city in 1958, which led to the demise of the Brooklyn neighborhood, which is in Second Ward. It was Second Ward. Is what we're experiencing right now with this violence and poverty and lack of economic mobility the result of what happened 61 years ago when they bulldozed a neighborhood? It all dates back to that? Anybody?
Okay.
No.
I was waiting.
No,
I was waiting.
Yes
and no. I think if you're talking about systemic inequity, it goes way back more than 60 some odd years ago. And I don't know if you were a part of the community read, The Color of Law, that a lot of folks here in Charlotte read earlier this year, but it basically lines out how de jure and de facto racism has led to systemic inequity. So I think there definitely were some intentional things that were done. On the other side of that, also, obviously, there is a personal responsibility that we each have to take for our own community and how we advocate and how we invest in each other to create and to advance community programs so that people do have opportunities economically. You already talked a little bit about the justice system and how returning citizens are able to go and be employed. And so we have to look at what are the other opportunities as well. So I think there are definitely historical factors, but then there are certainly opportunities to make changes today.
And that unconscious bias continues today
at
almost every level of our society, and we're unaware of it, and that's the pernicious nature of it, I suppose. But are there still things being done by governmental organizations that are causing this problem?
I think yes and no, right? I think in terms of government not being intentional in solving community problems, it's easier to run to the shite briny objects. We want to do soccer. We want to bring in a Lowe's that's coming uptown and bring IT jobs. Those things are needed. They're wanted. And they help build a city. But we've forgotten about those who live in the shadows for a long time. And I take responsibility too, because when I was on council before, you know, we were trying to do this. I know you hate this word, world-class city. And we did those things to kind of promote Charlotte, and we kind of forgot about quarters and neighborhoods and everyday people, those people who weren't among the 97 people moving to Charlotte every day, but those folks who call Charlotte home and live here.
Right.
And so we've forgotten about them, and we didn't invest in their communities. We weren't intentional about making sure that we tried to attract minority-owned business or a law firm or a dentist office or a CPA firm on Bayesford Road. You can't find any of those type of entities. But we were intentional about going out trying to bring the NASCAR Hall of Fame to Charlotte and trying to beat out of Atlanta.
Yeah.
Why can't we invest in a small business owner on the corridor?
Well, Renee, you have the real estate background. We've done a lot of shows about these food deserts where you can't go and you can't get fresh fruits and vegetables because there are no grocery stores, and it takes some of these people who live in these areas, they don't have transportation, so it'll take them 45 minutes to get to a grocery store and 45 minutes to get back, and once they shop, that's 3 hours out of their day, makes it impossible for them. So how does the city council encourage a grocery store or any business for that matter to locate in these economically stressed areas in such a way that it will help the people who are living there as opposed to shoving them out?
One of the things we talk about in Charlotte is it becoming a city of haves and have-nots.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that District 4 is kind of a microcosm of that. We have areas that have this wonderful development, fastest growing, and then we have areas also in District 4 that aren't benefiting from that type of development. So that's one of the things I would want to look at is bringing, we have a food desert right in our area in District 4. I'd like to offer or look at incentives for businesses. We look at small business development. The county has some small business grants. So we need to really invest in small businesses and organizations that are that want to do that type of work in the communities. Yeah.
Have we been doing that at the council level?
We've been trying. Yeah, it's challenging. I met with one of the low-price grocers that have been coming into the area about a year and a half ago and said, what would it take for you to move into a food desert? What if we gave you land? What if we, you know, did whatever we could? And they said, that's not what it is. We're low priced. That means we're reliant on people with automobiles, their SUVs coming in and buying a ton of groceries and filling up the car. If somebody's walking down the sidewalk to buy their groceries, that's not the client that we're attracting.
Huh.
We're low price, so we need high volume. So it's challenging. It's a business decision on their part.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But if
right.
we keep waiting for the economics to work for the big chains and even some of the lower price chains.
Yeah, you're right.
It'll never happen,
right.
And that's why we have to incentivize someone in our community to open up in these food deserts.
So the mayor made a very successful push at getting people on board with making sure we have affordable housing. But it's not just affordable housing. It's the idea of housing stability, particularly if you want to impact upward mobility, economic mobility. What can council do to that end? And what is it doing to that end?
Transportation. That's the, you know, we really should now be moving past
right.
that phrase and talk about affordable living.
Yeah.
Because the two biggest components of a person's discretionary income is housing and transportation. And if we talk about a really healthy public transportation system and we invest in it, which is not a small sum of money, then all of a sudden you can redefine what affordable housing is.
But bus ridership has been falling.
Mm-hmm.
In recent years.
Yeah.
Does that include people who need it desperately to get around because they can't afford a car? Or?
Those might be the only ones using it.
Mm-hmm.
You have a choice. Why are you going to use it if the average trip is 90 minutes?
Okay, that's why. And we've known about this. I've been here a long time. And we've known about these ridiculously long bus trips for a very long time. And so we went away from direct routes to this hub and spoke thing, which I thought, that makes no sense at all. But I didn't say it. It just seems
why not?
Because if you got to go down, because that's not my job. But if you have to, if you're out in South Park and you want to go to the university area, why do you have to go downtown,
exactly.
transfer, and go to the?
Yeah.
Why would you do that? So now we're moving away from that. and we're still not there. Will we ever be there? And we're going to have John Lewis, who's the CAT CEO, on this program tomorrow. We'll talk about that.
So, and John talks about that. The number one thing is efficiency and reliability. If you have it, that's why the light rail ridership is up, because you know when it's going to come, more or less, and you know, and it's not going to stop in traffic. Until we are committed to making a huge investment in our bus system, and to get down to 30-minute average trip is going to take $34 million in operating funds and $50 million to buy 100 buses. And that's just with the crummy diesel fuel buses we have today. So double that for electric buses, right? So until we're making a major investment in our bus system, which some cities have done, nobody's going to want to ride the bus. Until we have dedicated bus lanes and we try them out at least, no one's going to see, wait a minute, I could be on that bus and get there a lot faster.
Where's this money going to come from?
That's the rub, right? It's an expensive proposition to do. And so, Council, we just had a great presentation on Monday night regarding this same topic. And the thing that pointed out to me was about $35 billion to kind of completely do
out. $34 million for the operating mechanics,
bus drivers. So it's a big number. But again, if council is not intentional about doing it, intentional about seeing this as a methodology to address the outward mobility, because people got to get to work, right? And they can't take 90 minutes to get there. And so, and the bus has to be reliable. So it's something that the council has to really be focused on.
So I've got 30 seconds left in this segment. So for those people who are critical of the streetcar, could the money that we're using to build the streetcar have been used to improve the bus system? And would we have been better off having done that?
I wasn't here to analyze the streetcar finances, but money, if the money can be used for transit, then that would be something that should be evaluated.
So transit's a big expensive item, a big ticket item. So is upfits for stadiums and new stadiums for sports and other things. We'll talk about that when we come back. We'll talk about the RNC when we come back, and spend a little bit more time on affordable housing as well with our four members of City Council, Julie Iselt, Malcolm Graham, Victoria Watlington, and Renee Perkins Johnson, on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're sitting here with four members of City Council. Mayor Pro Tem Julie Iselt is with us. Malcolm Graham from District 2. Victoria Watlington, a new member of Council from District 3. And another new member, Renee Perkins Johnson from District 4. I mentioned a second ago that we would have John Lewis, the CAT CEO, with us tomorrow morning at 9. But we are going to be preempted by the markup of the articles of impeachment tomorrow morning at 9, so we'll broadcast that show at a later date, we promise you, to talk about transit and things like that. Your Republican, where was I? I'm going to talk about affordable housing. Here we go. Renee, you're a former realtor. You believe that the city can create incentives for builders and landlords, and that the city could form engagement teams, your words, of government leaders, neighbors, legal professionals to seek solutions to our housing problems. The state has severely limited what can be in the city's toolkit in terms of incentives for affordable housing. So what kind of incentives do you believe could be offered, and how would these engagement teams work?
So the state has limited us as far as the inclusionary zoning, and that's mandating the developers to allot a certain amount of housing for, or a certain amount of units for affordable housing, but it's collaborative efforts. I've met with property owners, with landlords who are interested or have some interest in providing affordable housing. We have some petitions right now where there are developers and landlords that are voluntarily allotting units for affordable housing. So we need to bring those individuals to the table and perhaps work with the housing authority and the finance agency and educate property owners who would be interested in providing affordable housing. So, and then educating the community as well as far as gentrification. What does it mean when you sell your home? What's going to happen? So it's really a matter of working collaboratively with the property owners, with the other districts, because our residents in 2, 3, and 4, they're facing the same challenges with gentrification. So it's really getting the information out. What's it mean when you sell your home? What's it mean when your children sell your home? What's going to how does that increase your taxes? How does that lead to displacement? So it's a matter of really engaging the public and bringing the county with us and educating them as far as their taxes and aging in place. So it's a matter of information and collaboration.
And Victoria, one of the things you mentioned while running is that you hope to, quote, reconsider the minimum housing code to prevent demolitions of lower income housing. Mm-hmm. Explain that.
Yeah, sure. So if you look at some of the suggestions for the new minimum housing code, with intent to hold landlords' feet to the fire in terms of making sure that they're meeting our housing code, on a large scale for developers, or not developers, but landlords that we understand have had a history of not being up to code and having a history, like Lake Arbor, for instance. Mm-hmm. But as you saw with Lake Arbor, my concern with the some of the penalties and the way that the minimum housing policy is structured is that it's going to create a situation where it's cheaper to tear down or to have.
So how do you lessen the restrictions, mm-hmm. or loosen the codes while still providing safe, adequate, mm-hmm. housing?
Sure. So I don't think it's about loosening the codes. I think it's about having a stratified approach to correcting the issues. So I think that you have to take a look at, first of all, what is the history of the landlord? What are the nature of the violations? How can we get to a place where the tenants are in a sustainable living environment without creating a situation where it's easier to demolish and then build market rate housing? So I think it's about not painting with a broad brush and really right-sizing the corrective action.
The last council just passed, just before you took office, rezoning ordinances for construction within a half mile of either side of the blue, mm-hmm. line and all future transit, mm-hmm. rail lines. That would allow for greater density and would allow for incentives for builders to go a little higher with, mm-hmm. their building if they included in those projects affordable housing. Was that the right move? Because this is going to impact a half a mile in, mm-hmm. each direction. It's a mile in each direction, left and right, of these rail lines. So is that the right area? Because that's gonna create some gentrification.
Absolutely. I think time will tell. I do believe that as much as we can be a part of the planning and development process on the front end, creating site plans, not going straight conventionals or going to TOD and you may end up with one thing or something completely different, I think as much as we the community can be a part of that planning process, the easier or the better results that we will end up having. So my hope is that TOD
That's transit-oriented development.
Yes. My hope is that transit-oriented development does not cut the community out of that process, and also I'm hoping that it does not create a spillover effect. Well, we're right next to a TOD zone, so we should be able to go TOD as well.
And transit-oriented development, mm-hmm. is what?
So transit-oriented development is about how do we create alternative methods of transportation. If you live closer to a public transit line like the Blue Line or the upcoming Silver Line, how do we create ways to where you've got street frontage so that people can get around with multimodal transportation? So I might get off a bus and want to get on the line. I might want to walk here or bike here. I may want to live right here at the line so that I can jump right on and go this place or that place. So eliminating or minimizing that dependency on personal vehicles to be able to get around and reach amenities.
All right, let's talk about some other things that the council will be facing. Charlotte's about to host, getting ready to host, 8, 9, 10 months away from now, the Republican National Convention. It was a controversial decision for some on the last city council. Had the four of you, well, you were there, Julie, had the three of you who are new been there, what would your vote have been? Malcolm. I know what your vote would have been.
Yeah. I was a public speaker, and I would have voted no.
Okay. We'll talk about why in a second. Victoria?
I don't Monday morning quarterback. I don't have the data. I wasn't there. So who cares at this point? It's coming. What can we do about it?
Renee?
I agree. My opinion and $2.20 will get you a ride on the bus line. So we weren't a part of the decision. We can only be a part of the decisions and moving forward.
So, Malcolm, in talking about the RNC, you, mm-hmm. told the Charlotte Post that we can't be so politically correct as a city that we are morally wrong.
Yeah.
Wow. You've said that you can see no good in bringing the convention here, not even economic, not even the impossible to pay for PR that a city gets when a national convention is in its midst and it's going to be on television, et cetera?
Well, I admit that it's a deeply personal decision as well as a political decision for me as well. I see things with clear eyes, and obviously this is not a typical Republican National Convention, right? It's the President of the United States is the head of the RNC. He is the leader, and in my opinion, not the council's opinion, not the city's opinion, but Malcolm Graham's opinion is that the president is a racist, and he's a bigot. And I promised my sister, as I saw her in her casket, that I would fight racism and discrimination everywhere I see it. I see it in Pennsylvania Avenue, and I don't care to see it on the corner of Trade and Tryon Street.
And for those who don't know, your sister lost her life in the Mother Emanuel Church shooting in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
During the campaign, your website quoted you as saying, quote, "Charlotte has a choice. Will we start speaking truth to power? Will we draw a moral line? Will we push back on racism, discrimination, and hatred?" Were you speaking just locally or also referring to people in politics? Were you referring to the president?
I was speaking locally as well as nationally. For an example, Nikki Haley, a Republican, said 2 weeks ago that Dylan Ruth marked the meeting of the Confederate flag, that but for him, the Confederate flag was about ice cream, apple pie, and moral being morally right, mm-hmm. and that because he killed these people, he salted the meeting of the flag. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a whole lot of BS, right? It's politically convenient for her to say it. But it's morally wrong. We know the meaning of the flag, and but for those non-individuals dying in Charleston, that flag will be flying today.
I know you want to think forward, not backward. So the convention's coming in August. Are you concerned about this convention coming here, about what might happen here, or what it might say about Charlotte as a city who essentially stepped up and volunteered because no one else wanted it, volunteered to host this? Does it concern any of you?
I think you have to be concerned if you're going to plan well. Right. So if concern means cognizant of the risks and being able to create mitigation plans, I think absolutely. How do we make sure that our citizens are safe? How do we make sure that we put on a world class, to use your buzzword, Malcolm?
Not my buzzword.
Malcolm's like, distance me from that. No, but I think you have to approach it with a level of risk management. So.
Okay, I don't want to run out of time. We talk about the big kahuna in the room, and that's this. A big decision coming up moments from now is money to help Panthers owner David Tepper come to an agreement with Major League Soccer. They will be announcing, they think, we are told, the 30th expansion city on December 17th. That is next week. City Council's Economic Development Committee Chair James Mitchell is ready to go.
Yes, we want it. Yes, it's our number one priority. Yes, you know, I think the votes are there to support it, but I think most of us are comfortable participating with the tourism fund between $100 million and $110 million.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Julie Eiselt. Some of you aren't so sure about how that much money going to this effort. You're among those people, if I'm correct.
No, I want to correct that. That's not what I said. I said that Mr. Mitchell had told a news outlet that we would give $100 million, and that's just not the way it works. There is a negotiation. Right. The negotiation presently is between MLS and David Tepper.
Okay. You've also, Mr. Mitchell also called the council's, called this the council's number one priority.
That's not my number
really?
One priority.
Really?
No.
It's very exciting. It's a big deal. You can't stack up priorities one after another in a city like this or in any city.
So clearly, Major League Soccer wants to know that the stadium will be upfitted for soccer. Some things have to happen. Clearly, David Tepper wants this team, and it's certainly his to lose, it appears, but he is very rich, maybe you've heard, and he's very likely to come back to the city in a few years to ask for money for a new football stadium. How would it be viewed if City Council chose not to fund this ask, or to fund it at a substantially lower amount than $100 to $150 million? How would that be seen?
You asking me?
I
think, you know, the question is, I would turn it around. What's the return on the investment to the city, right? Whether it's a dollar or $5 or $10, what do we get in return? Obviously, he's the wealthiest NFL owner of all 32 teams. You know, we have to be aware of what's happening around us, i.e. he just bought a golf course in Rock Hill that you can put a stadium on, I guess, right? And a parking deck, and even maybe a soccer facility. So we have to be cognizant of what's happening around us.
So where would this money come from? Where would this money come from? I have a minute left. Where would this money come from?
Hotel, motel tax, those types of things.
Is there enough money in that fund to do that and all the other things it does and wants to do in the future?
To be determined.
Okay. Well, you got a week. You got less than a week. And you know, they're going to make a decision on December 17th. So you can't sit here and tell me that you have not been talking about this furiously behind the scenes. Maybe you're already in discussions about this. Maybe the decision has already been made by council, has it?
Well, I can't tell you that. You just said if we were talking
just
about
us.
It.
Just us.
I can tell you that if we use money to assist this process, we're not giving a check to a person who's leaving town or could leave town. Tourism funding has to go towards infrastructure that supports tourism. And that's how, if you look at historically how our tourism fund has been used, those are proceeds that come in from hospitality and tourism activities. They go to infrastructure that supports tourism.
So has a decision been made already?
I mean, I'm not at the negotiating
You're
table.
You're meeting Monday.
I haven't voted on Tuesday. Anything. this whole, we're all council members. We're
all
not.
Right. Julie Eisel, not giving me the answer I want to hear. Mayor Pro Tem Malcolm Graham from District 2, Victoria Watlington from District 3, Renee Perkins Johnson, all new members. She's from District 4. Thank you all for
Thank
being here.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.